A whole new meaning to banker's hours today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Greece, the economy nears its breaking point. The banks are closed today and for the rest of the week. As you'll hear, it's causing big headaches. Also today, a story about Liberland, Europe's newest country, at least according to its founder, a man named Witt.
Hundreds of thousands of people have expressed interest in becoming Liberlandians, which entails filling out an online form and uploading a CV. Witt's only awarded citizenship to a hand-selected 100 so far.
Plus, why it's really hard to jettison the language of tall ships.
You could find any port in a storm. You could do something that's above board. You could be green, meaning a novice.
Salty language coming up today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Greece seems to be at an economic breaking point. Bailout negotiations with the country's eurozone partners have stalled. Greek banks are closed today, and Greeks can only withdraw the equivalent of 60 euros, or about 66 bucks, per day from ATMs. On Sunday, Greece will hold a referendum on whether to accept the eurozone's latest bailout offer. If the Greeks say no, the country may well default and end up leaving the single currency. Let's go to Athens and hear from Greek political correspondent Christos Michalidis. He explained how his wife tried to stock up at the supermarket today.
She told me that most of the shelves were empty, especially those that had pasta, especially those that had rice. A lot of people are buying pasta and rice, especially those shelves that also had milk and eggs. And a lot of pre-packed foods, like in canned foods, like tomato, tuna, beans, and things like that.
So things with a long shelf life, presumably people kind of
that's right, which
planning
means that,
ahead.
Yeah, it means that people are actually thinking that most possibly in the weeks to come, they'll have to think about other ways of manipulating their everyday diet.
What about you, Chrysos? What kind of things have you found yourself doing that are pretty out of the ordinary? Have you done your daily run to the ATM?
Well, I went to the ATM the same night that the referendum was announced by the government. That was on early morning hours on Saturday, and I was just lucky enough that I had to go to Athens airport to welcome a family member. So at the airport, there weren't a lot of people there at that time. There are some banks which are open 24 hours a day, and I just happened to be able to get some money out of the ATM. This money will last me for about a week, I guess, so without me needing to go back. But we have a young son in our family who just started his first job, actually, not even a month ago. Mm. And he's very happy about it. Today was the last day of the month, and they should pay him. He would get his first salary today ever in his life. He's still a happy young lad. I mean, he's happy to be going to work. He loves what he's doing, but already he's beginning to worry. What am I going to find money in my bank account tomorrow? It's the first time he opened a bank account here in Greece because he studied abroad, and he's looking forward to this moment. It's the first money that he's actually worked for.
Wow.
He doesn't know if certainly he knows that if it is in his account tomorrow, he'll just be able to withdraw 60 euros. It's not a big problem. There are many people whose lives depend on being able to find some money tomorrow, and they are pensioners who I saw today in queues outside banks who do not have plastic cards. They don't have these ATM cards because we're talking about people who are 70 years old, 80 years old, even more.
Right.
And as you might know, they're not acquainted with this plastic money. They are, some of them are also even afraid of it. So they were holding their little bank booklets, as we call them here in Greece, and they were trying to get into the bank. A few employees are still in the buildings, but they are just on an emergency call just to help people outside and, you know, give them information about the ATMs. Now, these people, these pensioners, they are in need of the small amounts of money that they are looking forward to withdraw. It's not a very nice picture at all.
Well, I mean, first job, first paycheck for your son, that really puts things into perspective. You say for him it's not a big problem as it is for others, but what if it does go on for more than a week? I mean, then it is a problem, and first of the month, I don't know about Greece, but here that's when my bills are due.
Yeah, and my bills are due as well. On the 15th of every month, I have to pay my mortgage. And if the banks are closed, I don't have a direct debit arrangement with my bank. So I just will not be able to pay my monthly mortgage. Also, what about the big businesses and the smaller businesses, the medium-sized businesses? They will need to pay their employees. They will need to buy their raw materials or their products that they sell. There we are going to have quite serious problems indeed.
Journalist Christos Michalidis speaking with me from Athens. Let's look now at how the crisis in Greece might affect us here in the U.S. Jacob Kierkegaard is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. So, Jacob, can the troubles in Greece affect the United States?
Well, I think we're seeing it already today. I think we're going to expect a minor sell-off in the markets, sort of a knee-jerk reaction, flight to quality, et cetera. But I actually don't think it's going to extend much beyond today, and certainly not develop into something that is material for the U.S. economy, because the reality is that the U.S. exposure to Greece, either through the banking system or exports to Greece, et cetera, is actually quite limited and therefore not materially going to affect us here in the United States. The real risk is that the spillover from Greece will negatively affect the broader European economy. And that, again, then will have a negative impact on the U.S. But even there, I am relatively optimistic because I think the reality is that even when you look at the other European countries, the direct and total exposures to Greece are relatively limited. And secondly, if the spillover actually turned out to be material, I would expect the European Central Bank to intervene forcefully and effectively in the financial markets to counter such risks.
But one of the scenarios here that a lot of people are worried about is the Grexit. If Greece leaves the European Union, I mean, wouldn't that just create all sorts of knock-on effects on the European economy, taking out any confidence in what the EU actually means around the world? Could that have an effect on the U.S.?
It could. But I think the chances that it would are actually quite small, because I think the fears about a Grexit are, in my opinion, quite exaggerated. There's no doubt that a Grexit would be an absolute disaster for Greece. But there is, in my opinion, relatively limited, little risk that other countries in the Eurozone would want to emulate such a disaster. And therefore, the idea that the departure of Greece from the Eurozone sort of inevitably leads to the collapse of the entire euro is, in my opinion, excessively alarmist. I don't think that's going to happen.
So Greece is, in your opinion, an outlier and won't affect us here in the U.S.? I mean, why are people making this seem like it's the end of the world?
Well, I think it's because people are making the conceptual wrong analogy. They're assuming that anything that happens in Greece, Grexit, et cetera, leads to the inevitable collapse of the euro as a whole. And I just think that's wrong, because we're not talking about the dissolution of the euro here. We're talking about a country trying to reintroduce its own currency. So I think it's simply the follow-on, knock-on, assumed effects of what will happen in Greece will inevitably happen to the rest of the eurozone, which I think are just simply an apples and oranges comparison.
So as hands are ringing across Europe, it seems, what should the U.S. and U.S. markets be doing and thinking about right now?
No, I think the U.S. and U.S. markets should clearly be worried about what happens in Greece. But I think at the same time, they shouldn't freak out about it, because we are talking about less than 2% of the Eurozone economy, which, dramatic and traumatic as it is for Greece, as I said earlier, does not have much of a spillover on the rest of the Eurozone or even the United States. What I think they should, however, do is, I think it would be entirely appropriate for the U.S. government to ask the Europeans to basically use money that has already been politically earmarked for Greece to pay Greece's debt to the IMF tomorrow, because it would mean that there would be no default by Greece before the referendum on Sunday.
Jacob Kierkegaard with the Peterson Institute speaking with me from Washington. Thank you for your time and explaining this to us.
My pleasure.
Greece has its problems for sure, but it seems downright stable compared to another country in Europe, Liberland. If you've never heard of it, I'm not surprised. Liberland is not recognized by any UN member nation. It doesn't really have a population or an infrastructure. It's really just a little spot of land along the Danube River. Here's regular contributor Alina Simone.
It's hard to know how seriously to take Vit Jedlica, the self-appointed president of Liberland. His website sells T-shirts that say, "Sex, Drugs, and Liberland." Yet, if he's playing the straight man, then he is seriously committed. When I reached him by Skype, he was at the G7 meeting in Germany.
You know, to get more contacts to the diplomacy as well as to newspapers to push the idea of Liberland forward.
Pushing that idea forward includes a bold economic foundation for his microstate, voluntary taxation.
And people will just be able to put their money where they think it is necessary.
When he announced his new nation on a piece of land between Serbia and Croatia, libertarians of the world rejoiced. But that was 2 months ago, and the hype has died down. So what's the state of the 3-square-mile nation? Is there an actual settlement in Liberland yet?
Well, there was one. But it was sort of taken apart by Croatia police.
While Serbia seems pretty chill about the whole thing, Croatia is not amused. Earlier this month, 4 Liberlandians took a small motorboat out there and were arrested by Croatian police. But Vip says he believes the Croatians will come around once they realize Liberland...
It's mainly about love and love. And freedom, and you know, we exactly have these two things in right in the name, right?
But ultimately, there may be strength in numbers. You're listening to the Liberland National Anthem, by the way. Hundreds of thousands of people have expressed interest in becoming Liberlandians, which entails filling out an online form and uploading a CV. Vit's only awarded citizenship to a hand-selected 100 so far. Eric Lyman is citizen number 1. He's a freelance writer based in Rome who wrote about Liberland for USA Today. I was skeptical. Journalists will do anything for a story, even apply for citizenship to a country that doesn't exist. But when I reached Lyman by Skype, he surprised me.
I mean, it seems to me that if you identify a piece of unclaimed land, you ought to be able to develop it and so on. And I have my objective point of view as a journalist, but in a way, I'm kind of cheering for them as well.
This isn't Lyman's first experience with a micronation. He grew up in South Florida, where in 1982, the U.S. Border Patrol set up a checkpoint on the highway leading to the Florida Keys in search of drugs and illegal immigrants. As a kind of satiric protest, the mayor of Key West declared the Florida Keys the Conch Republic.
And Jimmy Buffett was like the poet laureate, and they made their own currency and whatever. And the airport in Key West said, "Welcome to the Conch Republic."
Lyman wasn't able to actually stake a welcome sign on Liberlandian soil due to the vigilance of Croatian officials, but he did get to gaze at it from across the Danube.
It is beautiful in a way. It reminds me of sort of the rolling hills and the foothills of the Appalachians, you know?
And while this is totally undeveloped land, no water, no sewage, no buildings, it's definitely enough for Vit.
My dream and my idea about this, that we will be able to reach the land and start building there by 6th of September. That is my birthday.
What if he gets his birthday wish? I mean, are we too cynical to believe a new nation fueled by love and liberty could ever succeed? It's an open question, and if you have the answer, there are about a half dozen more pieces of disputed land along the Danube, ripe for settlement. For The World, this is Alina Simone.
You won't find it used for hopscotch, but math professors love it. I'll explain later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. And for the next few minutes, let's take to the high seas.
Brethren, 'tis no longer befitting for the likes of us to pass judgment on him. He'll be coming face to face with old Flint himself, he will, and be made to give proper accounting for his evil ways. Amen.
The actor Robert Newton playing Long John Silver in one of the pirate shows of the 1950s. You can practically smell the rum on his breath. Chris Wolfe, did all sailors used to talk like that?
Absolutely not. Newton is known now as the patron saint of International Talk Like a Pirate Day, and it's very unlikely that many sailors spoke like that. He was just asked by his director to try and sound a little bit more exotic for the first Treasure Island movie in 1950 and decided to go back to his roots, and that's an English West Country accent. A lot of people talk like that in Devon and Cornwall and Dorsetshire now.
This is Chris Wolfe, of course, the world's one-man history desk and something of a connoisseur of old sea shanties. So what was or is the actual language of the high seas then?
Well, of course, there was never one single language spoken on the high seas, but English, an English-based language, did come to dominate from around 1700 through about 1975. You know, and you got to think that in every culture there's a need for a kind of a multinational, multiracial crew to understand each other and what they're saying. There's a lot of technical terms to throw in there as well. And so there's words from the ancient languages, like captain comes from Latin, because people have been sailing since the dawn of time. Then there's words that come in from the big trading nations of the late Middle Ages, like skipper comes from Dutch, admiral from Italian. And then English comes to dominate, but all kinds of other foreign terms come in, like shanty is allegedly French, deco is a Hindi word for having a look around, shufti is an Arabic word for the same thing. And then Native American languages like hammock and hurricane, those are Carib words. So even in the as early as the 18th century, you see writers talking about how incomprehensible sailors were because they had their own language. So it was totally misunderstood by landlubbers.
So Chris, give us a few examples of some words that have come off the high seas and which we now use in regular everyday speech.
There are almost too many to count, Marco. You could find any port in a storm. You could do something that's above board. You could press gang someone into working for you. You could be green, meaning a novice. In England, the nursery of the Royal Navy, as they used to call it, was the Newfoundland cod trade, going off to fish for cod off of Newfoundland. Every ship was required by law to bring 10% of its crew as new hands, people who had never been to sea before. And they were always seasick, so they're always considered green.
Mm. And you were saying earlier, even the cat's out of the bag?
Absolutely. This is more of a Royal Navy kind of thing. The cat of nine tails was the whip with nine strands that was used for punishment. And so when you saw the cat coming out of the bag, you knew someone was in trouble. Also, though, you couldn't swing a cat of nine tails below deck because there's no room to swing a cat. And you'd be over a barrel waiting for your punishment because that's where you'd be tied up.
Wow. We could go on all day, it sounds like. It's not just language, is it? It's culture.
Well, yes, their seamen were distinguished, you know, up to the modern period by their dress, by their walk, trying to adjust for the pitch and roll of the ship. And they danced differently, obviously. They stood in one place instead of moving around. And customs like, you know why good children are taught not to put their elbows on the table.
Wow, this goes back to the ships too.
Exactly, because when you're on a sailing ship, you need to put your elbows on the table to hold your bowl, to keep your food steady from sliding across the table, so you could just like dip your bread in and eat like that. So when a press gang broke into a pub looking for people to push into the Navy, they'd be looking for anybody sitting with their elbows on the table. So good boys wouldn't do that, so they don't get press ganged.
I love talking to you. So today, the crews on these big ships taking containers all over the world, it's an international scene, very international crew. What's happened to the language?
Well, English is still kind of the official language of navigation on the seas as it is in the airwaves. We've all heard, you know, international pilots speaking English or trying to. Below decks, though, is probably a different story. Most of the crews come from the Philippines, so they're probably speaking Tagalog or other Philippine languages. But the culture has all changed because you only need a handful of men to run one of these giant container ships, whereas you may have used to have had 50 or more people on board a ship. And at the same time, they're coming in and out of dock to unload. They can unload one of those giant container ships in 24 hours and get back to sea, which is exactly what, you know, a good shipping company would want to do to maximize their profit and avoid idle time. So, you know, used to be join the Navy, go see the world kind of thing, and you spend time in foreign ports. It doesn't really happen that way.
The World's Chris Wolf. I guess my one addition here is anchors away. Thank you.
Stay on an even keel, Marco.
If you want to find nautical terms today, the best thing to do is look up in the sky and find an airplane. Think about it. Captain, galley, measuring speed in knots. Our next story is about a plane. It's called Solar Impulse 2, and it's not speedy, but that's not really the point. As the name implies, it's a completely solar-powered plane, and it's currently trying to make a round-the-world voyage. Swiss pilot André Borschberg is en route from Japan to Hawaii as we speak. This is the longest flight the plane has made on its journey around the globe so far.
This particular flight is really on the edge of the envelope. It's a five-day flight. He's committed now. He's past the point of no return, so hopefully everything will work out.
John Hansman is a professor of aeronautics at MIT. He says Solar Impulse 2 is a unique aircraft.
This airplane, it's entirely solar powered. It has batteries on board to help make it through the night. But the pushing the envelope, I really meant in terms of the flight. This is a five-day flight. The longest that he's flown it before is 2.5 days. If they hit any bad weather, it's a real problem. In a cloudy area, it can't refuel with the sunlight. So making Hawaii is really, they're really exposed right now trying to make it.
So Borschberg and the whole team, I mean, this is historic is what you're saying.
If he makes it, he'll essentially, I think, double the solo endurance flight record. And it's really tough, just physically tough in terms of the temperatures on board. There's no pressurization in this airplane. So he's got oxygen when he's at altitude, but the temperatures will be down minus 20, minus 30 at high altitude, and then it'll get hot when he gets low. He's got to go basically 5 days without any sustained sleep. And that just presumes there's no weather problems. Then if he has a technical problem with the airplane, it'd be tough.
The pictures we're seeing are pretty incredible. The wings on that plane and the lights along the wings. I mean, they're big wings, a lot of lights on them. I assume there has to be a lot of solar panels to get enough energy to power the plane. But is the trick here getting the ratio of the solar panels to the plane weight just right in order to get it off the ground and be efficient?
Well, it's not so much about getting it just right. You need to get it to work, period. So in order to make the wings big enough to get enough solar panels to be able to charge up the batteries, they're so big and need to be so light that they become flexible. And they can be so flexible that in certain conditions, the wings may break. So you're really, like, say, pushing the envelope in the technology of wing construction. You're pushing the envelope in the technology of the battery system, in the power system. You're pushing the envelope in terms of the physical capability of the pilot. And you're pushing the envelope in terms of having that weather window that's open enough to make it.
I'm sure the Wright brothers had to consider these things when they were innovating their fossil fuel airplane. But, I mean, does that mean we will see a solar-powered plane in commercial use in the future someday?
I think the technology or just the physics don't really work in order to have an airplane that would be able to fly solar-powered missions. So to carry a human, it's really tough. To carry a human with payload is even tougher. I do think you'll see solar-powered airplanes that are used for unmanned airplanes, but probably not many manned airplanes.
John Hansman, professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, thank you for your time.
No problem.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Japanese brand of chalk is in dwindling supply. No big deal, except for mathematicians.
95%, if not more, adore using a chalkboard. It is the bread and butter of the work that we do.
The Rolls-Royce of chalk, that story, plus the latest on the terror attacks in Tunisia. That's coming up here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Tunisia is still reeling from a deadly terrorist attack last week. On Friday, a gunman opened fire on sunbathers in the Tunisian town of Sousse. Some 38 people, most of them European tourists, were killed. The gunman, identified as Saifedine Rezgi, was shot dead by police on the scene. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, and reports indicate that the gunman may have been radicalized only recently. Reporter Marine Olivezi went to Rezgi's hometown today. It's a town called Garfour.
And it's a small place that's only an hour and a half away from the capital, but very far away from the glitz of Tunisia's coastal resorts. And everybody I talked to there, whether neighbors, friends, relatives, including his father, they were at a loss to explain what happened to Saifedean Rezgi. He was still in Darfur the day before the attack, and they say he was acting totally normal, breaking the fast of Ramadan with his family, going to work at a local cafe in the evening to get some money, the same routine as usual. And one of his friends told me the only way he could make sense of it all was to think that he was living a double life, and it didn't let anything transpire whenever he was back home. Now, I also went to the town where he was doing his master's degree, and that's where his family believes he was radicalized. The only link so far tying him to a radical group is the Islamic society that he was part of at his university. It is possible that some of the young men there had gone either to Syria or Libya and influenced him, but at this point, there's still a lot of mystery shrouding his case.
Is there any evidence to suggest that Rezgi himself went abroad and was radicalized somewhere outside of Tunisia?
No, so far not at all. The authorities say that he had a passport, but he never used it, which rules out the possibility that he traveled to Syria or neighboring Libya, unless he smuggled himself into the country. But the family also says they saw him every weekend or so, so it's not like he disappeared for weeks at a time. And it's not clear whether he'd received actually any kind of training at this point, because we heard eyewitnesses from Friday's rampage saying that in the first few minutes of the shootout, Saifedean didn't seem to have a good grip on his assault rifle, and his shots were sloppy. Then he steadied himself and started to shoot more methodically, reloading multiple times. Now, it's obviously really hard to say if that's something anybody can do with little to no training.
Tell me, Marine, it seemed to be that there was perhaps more than one shooter on Friday. Is the narrative now focusing strictly on Rezgi as the only attacker?
Well, there have been conflicting reports. What the authorities have said yesterday is that they're looking for accomplices. They believe that he could not have done that on his own, and he had received help to prepare the attack. But the authorities at this point say that he was the only one that day to open fire at tourists.
Now, Marine, you also said you spoke with Rezgi's father. What was he feeling when you spoke with him, and what kind of things did he tell you?
Well, he didn't want to be interviewed, so it was more of a off-the-cuff comments. Obviously, a lot of journalists had gone there, and he himself had only returned to his house after having been taken into custody with his wife and one of his daughter the day before. So he was very tired, looked very wary of all the attention surrounding his family. Throughout the maybe half an hour we spent around his house, there were a lot of people, locals, who would come to him and just hug him. He did say that he just had no clue of what could have happened to his son.
So this town, his Rezgi's hometown of Darfur, what kind of town is it?
It's very representative of that split that exists in Tunisia between the towns on the coast that have gained a lot of wealth throughout the years through tourism industry. Mm. And the house where his family lives is just a one-story house, whitewashed walls, and not much to say. His family was working class, nothing very distinctive about it.
Right. We do know that Tunisia has seen a lot of its citizens drawn to ISIS, more so proportionally than most countries, in fact. Do you know why that is, Marine? What are the connections between ISIS and Tunisia?
Well, we know indeed that that's the country that have sent the highest number of jihadists to Syria since 2012. And with the opening of the country after 2011, that has allowed a lot of groups and more radical Islamist groups to openly preach on the street, which was something that was impossible under the former regime. The mosques, for instance, were very tightly controlled. The imam could not say a word outside of what was set for him by the Ministry of Religious Affairs. And all of a sudden, the freedom that came in the wake of the Arab Spring allowed all of these groups to do whatever they wanted. And one of the blame has been put on all these mosques. There are about 150 mosques since 2011 that have sprung up across the countries without authorization, privately owned, privately built. And some of those have been preaching a very radical version of Islam. We know that in Europe, for instance, the radicalization operated online, mm-hmm. Facebook, and so on, away from the mosque. But in Tunisia, these mosques and these groups were able to operate and to preach openly on the streets.
Marine Olivezi speaking with me from Sousse in Tunisia. Thank you very much for the update, Marine.
My pleasure, Marco.
Here's the story of another person seemingly inspired by ISIS. I'm talking about a 23-year-old Sunday school teacher in rural Washington State. This woman, with the pseudonym Alex, started corresponding with ISIS on Twitter. She wanted to know why the group beheads people. A group of ISIS supporters, including someone named Faisal Mustafa, responded to her tweets, and those responses put her on a dangerous path towards Syria. Rukmini Kalamaki is with the New York Times. She followed Alex and Faisal's correspondence to better understand how ISIS works. Kalamaki told me Alex was surprised by the tone ISIS took with her.
They were incredibly nice to her. You know, they were very polite. They were very conscientious. Mostly men would spend hours and hours speaking to her without any sort of sexual innuendo, which, of course, is reassuring for a young woman. Mm-hmm. And she got caught up in this idea that we have misunderstood them.
And so she calls this one man a friend, a mentor. Did they actually exchange names? I mean, how well did she get to know him?
She knew his real name, which she ended up passing on to us. He knew her real name. He obviously knew her address because he was sending her packages. So there was a level of intimacy there that in retrospect is a little bit frightening.
So what exactly did he tell her? I mean, what was her attraction to him aside from the fact that he did not make sexual advances?
You know, by October of last year, she was spending, according to her grandmother, about 7 hours a day talking to these people, 7 hours every single day. And for a young woman who doesn't have, who is underemployed, she was working, I think, 2 days a week as a nanny, and who doesn't have a lot going on in her life, this very quickly became her social circle. And in a way, it's easy to see how this happened. They are so polite. They are so kind. They are so conscientious towards her. And I think if you don't have a very firm sense of self, at a certain point, when you spend months, you know, involved in this, I see how one can lose themselves.
So Alex, the pen name of this girl, originally wanted to find out more about Islam. Ultimately, did it look like there was a risk of her leaving the United States and joining an extremist group?
At the very end, so we're talking now February, March of the six-month journey, he began talking to her about coming to meet him in Austria in order to meet her future husband. And he described her future husband as a 45-year-old bald man, but who was a very good Muslim. And I think what caused her to put on the brakes is at a certain point, he shifted his attention from her to her and her little brother. And her little brother is only 11, and he's currently in foster care. The conversation became, how can you get him out of foster care? And I think at that point, whereas I think she had lost herself, I think her love for her brother, which transcends possibly any love that she has in her family, is the thing that made her wake up. And she realized, oh my God, my little brother could end up, you know, being privy to beheadings, being involved in atrocities. And that's what brought the pause. And it was at that moment that her family was able to intervene and kind of pull her back from the edge.
So she was to meet her future husband in Austria, and the man, her main interlocutor, was in the UK. I mean, this is all over the place. Is this man, Faisal Mustafa, is he an actual ISIS operative or a sympathizer? How would you describe him?
We don't actually know what he is. What's clear from his messaging towards her is that he is a sympathizer of extreme Islam, or of radical Islam, as we would call it. But he was very, very careful in how he spoke to her, and we suspect that this is because he's living in England. And so, for example, he never spoke of her migrating to Syria. He always talked about, you're now a Muslim, Alex, and as a good Muslim, you need to migrate to a Muslim land. She understood it to be Syria, but he never actually uttered it. And that brings up a whole other issue, which is the subterfuge that is now being employed to lure young people.
You know, there's something I read this morning that suggested ISIS has achieved what Al-Qaeda never did. And we see this not just with recruitment, but also perhaps with the attacks on France, Tunisia, and Kuwait last Friday. This decentralization of the operation, whereby you don't really need command and control in one place like Syria or Iraq. All you need are sympathizers who adhere to the ideology of ISIS. Do you think that's the case with Faisal Mustafa?
First of all, I think that Al-Qaeda has also done this to a certain degree, where we see with Inspire magazine, the Tsarnaev brothers in Boston used that magazine to learn how to make the pressure cooker bomb that ended up causing the terrible atrocity in Boston without ever having any contact directly with Al-Qaeda, as far as we know. And I think ISIS, because of their sophistication on social media and on the internet, has taken this to another level. Their propaganda machine is so rich. You can go online, you can find these videos, you can find almost like a step-by-step curriculum that takes you ever closer to this extreme ideology. And you can do this in the privacy of your own bedroom in rural Washington with your family watching Fox News in the other bedroom, which is exactly what was the scenario for Alex, with no one knowing until you're almost, you know, too far down that road.
Rukmini Kalamaki with the New York Times reported on this girl named Alex. Rukmini, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
In this age of PowerPoints and dry erase boards, this next story might surprise you. It's about an old-fashioned classroom tool, chalk. But not just any chalk, a Japanese brand called Hagoromo Full Touch Chalk. And it's about to get a whole lot harder to find. The company that makes it says it will be going out of business. And that worries professors like Satyan Devados. He teaches mathematics at Williams College in Western Massachusetts. Devados says that with Hagoromo Chalk, the math practically writes itself.
Let me try to put it to you this way. I guess it's kind of hard to understand if you're not holding it or if you don't use this chalk all the time. But a few things is the thickness of the chalk. It's noticeably thicker than normal chalk. And so it actually has a good heft to it when you pick it up. It has a wax coating on the outside of the chalk, so it actually doesn't get your fingers chalky and dry as you use it all the time. And actually, when you use it on a good blackboard, it melts beautifully. It's just elegant when you write.
So how many mathematicians still use blackboards and chalk in this day and age? I thought everybody had kind of switched to whiteboards.
Almost every math conference I go to, I would bet 95%, if not more, adore using a chalkboard. It is the bread and butter of the work that we do.
Is it a point of honor for mathematicians to continue using a blackboard?
Honor could be the wrong word, but there's a sense of notion of not losing it, right? I think what happened in the 80s and 90s is mathematics was combined with computer science. And around that time, because of the technological revolution, computers were easier to produce and became quite fast. And at that time, the computer science faculty actually preferred whiteboards because they didn't want chalk dust to interfere with their expensive computer equipment.
Huh.
But the math department, on the other hand, were these old stalwarts. I mean, nothing really changed from our perspective. So the math department's kind of held on to their love of chalkboards.
So tell me more about Hagoromo chalk and where it comes from in Japan. Is there like one particular place? Is there an actual chalk mine?
That is a brilliant question that I have no clue the answer for. I am just a user of this beautiful piece of wonder, but I don't know the technicality of what goes on behind the scenes. In fact, I didn't even know it was hard to come by till recently when I just found out that they were closing their stores.
And what are your plans to satisfy your Hagoromo chalk needs now that the company's going out of business?
I was just given a gift of a huge box worth, almost a crate's worth of chalk that I have in my office. So I think I'm gonna hold on to that. That'll last me for a while, and I could give that as gifts to my students down the line as well.
So you're kind of set for a while.
I am. I know. I think this notion of the value of chalk, certainly in the math world, is important because it's so easy to jump in and edit somebody else's work. And I think mathematicians also believe their work isn't just defined by that physical notion of what's on the board. There's something deeper going on behind the scenes. And I think chalk is the perfect medium to do this.
There's that great scene in Good Will Hunting where Matt Damon and the MIT prof are doing kind of almost like dueling equations. And there's a kind of musical quality to the chalk when it hits the board. Do you think that using better chalk makes you better at math?
Absolutely.
Without
a doubt. And I think, you know, the main reason, Marco, is because we are humans. And humans are not people of just minds, right? We have bodies. And, you know, we're very physical people. So the medium that we use is going to impact what we do. If you are in broadcasting, the type of mic that's placed in front of you, the type of desk you sit on, or the type of chair, all of these things provide better output.
Satyan Devados, a professor of mathematics at Williams College, thanks so much for your time.
Marco, thanks so much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Coming up next, devising a Plan B for Iran. You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International, with support from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Months of negotiations between Iran and the West could come to an end tomorrow. Tuesday is the official deadline set by all sides for a final nuclear deal. But it looks like that deadline might be pushed back as the sides continue to go back and forth. And then there's the tougher question, what if the talks fail altogether?
If there's no deal, I think there are, you know, attempts at more diplomacy and more economic sanctions.
That's Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Crowley says the U.S. has been working on a plan B in case all the diplomatic options fail. It involves a bomb called the MOP, or Massive Ordnance Penetrator.
The challenge, if you need to resort to a military option in Iran, is that Iran's uranium enrichment facilities are underground. In particular, one facility called Fordo is in a mountain. It may be as deep as 250 feet beneath the mountain rock. Our conventional bombs really can't do anything. You could carpet bomb it with B-52s with very little result. The remarkable thing about this bomb is you drop this 30,000-pound device from 20,000, 30,000 feet. It falls several hundred miles per hour, and it is designed, among other things, with an incredibly strong steel alloy exterior to drill through the rock for dozens or potentially, you know, 100 or more feet before its fuse explodes. So it's like Thor's jackhammer. I mean, just brute force physics that, in the words of one former Pentagon official who spoke to me for the story and who has seen video of this bomb being tested, it boggles the mind to see it in action.
Is it enough for the U.S. just to have this bomb as a threat? I mean, is the very existence of this MOP kind of aimed in part to dissuade Iran from ever getting their bomb?
Yes. You know, of course, it's sort of an old cliche. I think Ronald Reagan popularized the line, even if he didn't coin it, peace through strength. And, you know, if you talk to people in the administration and in the Pentagon, they feel that, you know, they hope they will never have to use this bomb, but they did fast track its development. As recently as a few years ago, there was a belief that we would, in fact, not be able to hit Fordo or other similar facilities that we may not know about with our existing bunker busting arsenal. So development was fast tracked to beef this thing up. There were modifications made as recently as last fall and this winter to improve, among other things, its accuracy. And the Pentagon has not hidden these facts. It does not mind Iran knowing that we have this option, because the feeling is we need this leverage. Iran needs to know that if it does not cut a deal, it can't walk away from the bargaining table scot-free and do whatever it wants, that we will, in effect, come and get them.
The diplomacy so far has been the P5 plus one. If at some point the U.S. decided to use this massive ordnance penetrator, which of the P5 plus one countries would also have to have their names on that bomb? Or would the U.S. do this alone?
Well, that's a very difficult question, and I don't think there's a simple answer. It would depend on a lot of factors, including how urgently we needed to act. I think ideally, we would like as much international support and legitimacy and participation as possible if it came to a military action. However, let's say hypothetically we found that Iran had a hidden facility where they were enriching uranium and they were close to having enough material for a bomb, and we felt that if we didn't get it within, you know, a month or two, it was going to be too late. We might have to act really fast. And I could speculate about members of that coalition. I think it's almost certain that China and Russia would oppose such an action. The political support would probably not be there in Great Britain. France has been quite hawkish on the Iranian nuclear question, so that's a possibility. Germany, I think, less likely. But it would be a very complicated international debate.
Michael Crowley with Politico, thanks very much for your time today.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we leave you, let's update a story we've been following. Over the past few weeks, cultural events here in the U.S. have seen a number of international performers disappear from the lineups. Chicago's Grant Park Music Festival, for example, abruptly lost all four of its British vocal soloists, and only one dancer from the Venezuelan dance company, Piso Rojo, got to Seattle, which made the Seattle International Dance Festival that much less international. The cause for all this chaos? It's a hardware problem at the State Department and has kept the United States from issuing visas for over 2 weeks. Matthew Covey is an attorney and runs Tamizdat, a consulting firm in New York that deals with foreign artists who need visas to perform here in the U.S. So this glitch of the State Department affected all visas, Matthew, not just visas for musicians. What is the latest? What have you heard from Washington?
What we're hearing is that all the embassies are back online now. The hardware problem is supposedly solved. The issue really right now we're seeing is people struggling with the backlog. State Department reported that there were about 335,000 visas backlogged. They're claiming that they have issued nearly 300,000 of those by the end of this weekend. So reportedly we're going to be back up to normal soon. I think the question really is how long are the ripple effects from the delays going to be felt by artists who are, you know, on the road and were unable to get the visas when they had planned on it?
Well, I know in the case of like King Sunny Ade from Nigeria, he was affected. He actually got his visa, but his band did not. Is that going to mean big complications for artists who have been booked for concerts through the whole summer?
I think it could. The effect is going to be a little limited. So the only people who are really affected are those who had counted on getting visas issued in the last 2 weeks, and given their tour schedules, they had to have them and then weren't able to. I'm dealing with one British band right now who's in a pretty rough situation because their tour in the U.S. doesn't start until the middle of July, but the problem is they were planning on being on tour in Canada, so we have to figure out how to get their visas issued while they're on the road in Canada touring. Logistically, it's kind of a nightmare.
Any visa troubles from the past 3 weeks and this computer glitch at the State Department that have meant tours got completely canceled?
There's a Peruvian tropical bass group called Dengue 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 that we were working on. Their whole tour got canceled. They couldn't get their passports back. The embassy just said, yeah, we'll get them back to you as soon as we can. And 2 weeks later, they were still waiting.
I know for you, Matthew, in your line of work, visa hurdles are business as usual. Generally, what challenges do international musicians face when coming to this country?
When the system works, which most of the time is the case, it's nothing more than a whole lot of bureaucratic hoops and a fair amount of expense. But really the problem is when you have an artist coming from a country that's, for example, seen as a security risk, or when an individual has something in their record, their name matches that of somebody who's done something wrong, or they in fact have a prior visa violation. The kinds of delays you can see can stretch for weeks to months, to in some cases years, and that certainly can shut down an artist's career in the U.S.
Matthew Covey, an attorney who runs Tamizdat, a consulting firm in New York that deals with these issues. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman signing off for today. We'll be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. At skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.